Travels with a Donkey in the Cevennes by Robert Louis Stevenson. Episode 2, Setting Out.
The bell of Monastier was just striking 9 as I descended the hill through the common. Modestine tripped along upon her 4 small hoofs with a sober daintiness of gait. From time to time she shook her ears or her tail, and she looked so small under the bundle that my mind misgave me. We got across the ford without difficulty, and once on the other bank, where the road begins to mount through pine woods, I took in my right hand the unhallowed staff, and with a quaking spirit applied it to the donkey. Modestine brisked up her pace for perhaps 3 steps, and then relapsed into her former minuet. Another application had the same effect, and so with a third. I am worthy the name of an Englishman, and it goes against my conscience to lay my hand rudely upon a female. I desisted, and looked her all over from head to foot. The poor brute's knees were trembling, and her breathing was distressed. It was plain she could go no faster on a hill. God forbid, thought I, that I should brutalize this innocent creature. Let her go at her own pace, and let me patiently follow. What that pace was, there is no word mean enough to describe. It was something as much slower than a walk as a walk is slower than a run. It kept me hanging on each foot for an incredible length of time. In 5 minutes it exhausted the spirit and set up a fever in all the muscles of the leg. And yet, I had to keep close at hand and measure my advance exactly upon hers. For if I dropped a few yards into the rear, or went on a few yards ahead, Modestine came instantly to a halt and began to browse. The thought that this was to last from here to Alais nearly broke my heart. In the meantime, there came up behind us a tall peasant, perhaps 40 years of age, of an ironical, snuffy countenance, and arrayed in the green tailcoat of the country. He overtook us, and stopped to consider our pitiful advance. "Your donkey," says he, "is very old?" I told him I believed not. Then he supposed we had come far. I told him we had but newly left the monastery. "Et vous marchez comme ça?" cried he, and throwing back his head, he laughed, long and heartily. I watched him, half prepared to be offended, until he had satisfied his mirth. "You must have no pity on these animals," said he, and, plucking a switch out of a thicket, he began to lace Modestine about the sternworks, uttering a cry. The rogue pricked up her ears and broke into a good round pace, which she kept up without flagging and without exhibiting the least symptom of distress as long as the peasant kept behind us. Her former panting and shaking had been, I regret to say, a piece of comedy. My deus ex machina, before he left me, presented me with the switch, which he declared she would feel more tenderly than my cane, and finally taught me the true cry, or Masonic word, of donkey drivers. Prut! I was proud of my new lore, and thought I had learned the word to perfection. And certainly Modestine did wonders for the rest of the forenoon, and I had a breathing space to look about me. It was the Sabbath, and as we came down through Saint-Martin de Fougères, the church was crowded to the door. It gave me a home feeling on the spot, for I am a countryman of the Sabbath, so to speak, and all Sabbath observances, like a Scottish accent, strike in me mixed feelings, grateful and the reverse. It is only a traveller, hurrying by like a person from another planet, who can rightly enjoy the peace and beauty of the great ascetic feast. The sight of the resting country does his spirit good. There is something better than music in the wide, unusual silence, and it disposes him to amiable thoughts, like the sound of a little river or the warmth of the sunlight. In this pleasant humour, I came down the hill to where Goudet stands in the green end of a valley. Above and below, you may hear wimpling over the stones an amiable stripling of a river, which it seems absurd to call the Loire. I hurried over my midday meal, and was early forth again. But, alas, As we climbed the interminable hill on the other side, Prut seemed to have lost its virtue. I prutted like a lion. I prutted mellifluously like a sucking dove. But Modestine would be neither softened nor intimidated. She held doggedly to her pace. Nothing but a blow would move her, and that only for a second before she relapsed into her own private gait. The sound of my own blows sickened me. Once, when I looked at her, she had a faint resemblance to a lady of my acquaintance, who formerly loaded me with kindness. And this increased my horror of my cruelty. To make matters worse, we encountered another donkey, ranging at will upon the roadside. He and Modestine met, nickering for joy, and I had to separate the pair and beat down their young romance with a renewed and feverish bastinado. If the other donkey had had the heart of a male under his hide, he would have fallen upon me tooth and hoof. And this was a kind of consolation. He was plainly unworthy of Modestine's affection. But the incident saddened me, as did everything that spoke of my donkey's sex. It was blazing hot up the valley, windless, with a vehement sun upon my shoulders. And I had to labour so constantly with my stick that the sweat ran into my eyes. Every 5 minutes, too, the pack, the basket and the pilot coat would take an ugly slew to one side or the other, and I had to stop Modestine just when I'd got her to a tolerable pace of about 2 miles an hour to tug, push, shoulder and readjust the load. And at last, in the village of Ussel, saddle and all, the whole hypothec turned round and grovelled in the dust below the donkey's belly. She, none better pleased, incontinently drew up and seemed to smile. I had the devil's own trouble to get the thing righted, and the instant I had done so, it toppled and fell down upon the other side. Not a hand was offered to assist me. It was the most despicable fix. I must plainly content myself with the pack for Modestine and take the other items for my own share of the porterage. I believe I may say I am not devoid of greatness of soul, for I did not recoil from this infamous burden. A little out of the village, Modestine, filled with the demon, set her heart upon a byroad and positively refused to leave it. I dropped all my bundles and, I am ashamed to say, struck the poor sinner twice across the face. It was pitiful to see her lift up her head with shut eyes, as if waiting for another blow. I came very near to crying. But I did a wiser thing than that, and sat squarely down by the roadside to consider my situation under the cheerful influence of tobacco and a nip of brandy. Modestine, in the meantime, munched some black bread with a contrite, hypocritical air. It was plain I must make a sacrifice to the gods of shipwreck. I threw away the empty bottle destined to carry milk, my own white bread, the cold leg of mutton, and the egg whisk, although this last was dear to my heart. Thus I found room for everything in the basket, and even stored the boating coat on top. By means of an end of cord, I slung it under one arm, and although the cord cut my shoulder and the jacket hung almost to the ground, it was with a heart greatly lightened that I set forth again. I now had an arm free to thrash Modestine, and cruelly I chastised her. If I were to reach the lakeside before dark, she must bestir her little shanks to some tune. Already the sun had gone down into a windy-looking mist, and although there were still a few streaks of gold far off to the east on the hills and the black fir woods, all was cold and grey about our onward path. I think every decent step that Modestine took must have cost me at least 2 emphatic blows. There was not another sound in the neighbourhood but that of my unwearying bastinado. Eventually, after a sharp ascent, we reached the edge of a plateau. Soon we were on a high road, and surprise seized on my mind as I beheld a village of some magnitude close at hand, for I had been told that the neighbourhood of the lake was uninhabited, except for trout. The road smoked in the twilight with children driving home cattle from the fields,
and a pair of mounted stride-legged women, hat and cap and all, dashed past me at a hammering trot from the canton, where they'd been to church and market. I asked one of the children where I was. "At Bouchy Saint-Nicolas," he told me. "Thither, about a mile south of my destination, and on the other side of a respectable summit, had these confused roads and treacherous peasantry conducted me. My shoulder was cut, so that it hurt sharply. My arm ached like toothache from perpetual beating. I gave up the lake and my design to camp, and asked for the auberge." The auberge of Bouchy Saint-Nicolas was among the least pretentious I have ever visited. Imagine a cottage of two stories with a bench before the door, the stable and kitchen in a suite, so that Modestine and I could hear each other dining. In the kitchen, cooking and eating go forward side by side, and the family sleep at night. Anyone who has a fancy to wash must do so in public at the common table. The food is sometimes spare. Hard fish and omelette have been my portion more than once. The wine is of the smallest, the brandy abominable to man, and the visit of a fat sow grouting under the table and rubbing against your legs is no impossible accompaniment to dinner. But the people of the inn, in 9 cases out of 10, show themselves friendly and considerate. At Bouchy, for instance, I uncorked my bottle of Beaujolais and asked the host to join me. He would take but little. "I am an amateur of such wine, do you see?" he said, "and I am capable of leaving you not enough." He was a mild, handsome, sensible, friendly old man, astonishingly ignorant. His wife, who was not so pleasant in her manners, knew how to read, although I do not suppose she ever did so. She had a share of brains, and spoke like one who ruled the roast. "My man knows nothing," she said, with an angry nod. "He is like the beasts." And the old gentleman signified acquiescence with his head. There was no contempt on her part, and no shame on his. The facts were accepted loyally, and no more about the matter. They were both much interested by the story of my misadventures. "In the morning," said the husband, "I will make you something better than your cane. Such a beast as that feels nothing. It is in the proverb, 'Dur comme un âne.' You might beat her insensible with a cudgel, and yet you would arrive nowhere." Something better. I little knew what he was offering. The sleeping room was furnished with 2 beds. I had one, and was a little abashed to find a young man and his wife and child in the act of mounting into the other. This was my first experience of the sort, and if I am always to feel equally silly and extraneous, I pray God it be my last also. I kept my eyes to myself, and know nothing of the woman except that she had beautiful arms, and seemed no whit abashed by the experience. I was up first, and hastened my toilette guiltily, so as to leave a clear field for Madame, the cooper's wife. I drank a bowl of milk, and set off to explore the neighbourhood of Bouchy. It was 5 in the morning, and I had to bury my hands in my pockets and trot. When I came back to the inn for a bit of breakfast, the landlady was in the kitchen, combing out her daughter's hair, and I made my compliments upon its beauty. "And where," said I, "is Monsieur?" "The master of the house is upstairs," she answered, "making you a goad."
Alan Cumming was reading the second episode of Travels with a Donkey in the Cevennes by Robert Louis Stevenson.